I believe that the cause of Governor Wallace will diminish, and that General LeMay, with all respect, will not save him, and that the American people will understand that repression, totalitarianism, is no substitute for law and freedom and government, and that if we have to solve our problems Governor Wallace's way, then we're fighting for something which is not America, but some new authoritarian Wallace state, in which I do not believe the American people believe. And I might tell you, too, that I take rather deeply to heart the endorsement of the Central Labor Council and of the state AFL-CIO, because I believe that being a man of action and of pragmatic thinking, I may be able to make working people feel that they do not have to go the Wallace way, that we can deal with our problems effectively, and that there are men of capacity whom they can entrust who will deal with them that way, and that Wallace represents a desperate alternative which America need not and should not embrace unless it is now ready to lose its freedom, which I do not believe it is.
Senator, what about the strength would indicate that there is a voice of dissent in this country that both parties are going to have to at least consider in their own respective courses of action. How will this Wallace sentiment, that whatever degree it may represent, will it affect your own future in the Senate, the way you vote?
I think I have voted and I have acted in the way which is the best calculated to obviate the appeal of Wallace's. I have been for the maintenance of order in our country, and I've supported it through the police, through our military forces, and in every other way. But I've also been for satisfying the demands which are based upon injustices long inherited and long endured. Fortunately, our country can do both with equal vigor, and that too obviates Wallace's, but that's not what Wallace thinks about. And therefore, I think that I represent as good an answer to Wallace as our people will find, at least in my state.
Senator, what about the question of the Central Labor Council endorsing both you and Vice President Humphrey? Will this make it uncomfortable for you, do you think?
Well, perhaps the question can best be answered by the fact that I am now on a political ticket, the Liberal Party ticket, upon which Vice President Humphrey is running also as the presidential candidate. And I'm neither embarrassed nor dismayed, nor are they. It is well known, and it was known to the Central Trades and Labor Council, that I support the Nixon ticket. The people of New York are well able to pick and choose, and they will decide who they want as their president, and they'll decide who they want as their senator. They won't be a bit confused. I would like to call to your attention that in 1 year, 1950, Impellitteri was elected mayor, Dewey was elected governor, Lehman was elected senator. So you leave it to our people. If they want to elect somebody, they know just how to do it.
Senator, being rather candid, how far ahead do you feel you are now from Mr. O'Dwyer and Ms. Buckner?
I have never predicted elections. I don't know that I'm ahead or behind. I feel that the case for re-election, which I've presented to the people of New York, has not been materially impaired by my opponent's attacks. I think the people have kind of shrugged them off.
What about your polls, though? What do they show?
I would say the polls show that I'm doing all right, but there's nothing sensational that polls convince me of. I'll be working just as hard.
Don't they show you're doing a little better than just all right?
Well, don't make my organization feel complacent. They're all here.
Do you think many people will be staying away from the polls on election days?
I think many people think today they're going to stay away, and I think many people think today they're going to vote for Wallace. But as that day approaches, as we say about the Day of Atonement in my faith, they change their minds, and they decide that they really want to be part of what's going to make this country work. Nobody thinks we're going under yet, and nobody thinks we need a man on horseback yet. And even many of those workers who were so exasperated, when they begin to face their consciences, you'll see that Wallace vote melt away like snow in the summer. Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much. And I apologize for keeping you waiting, but it was just the traffic. No fault of the mayor's.
What are you going to do about the traffic?
Well, gentlemen, you couldn't give me a nicer welcome. Gentlemen, you couldn't give me a nicer welcome, one that would please me more. And President Woods couldn't please me more by putting me on so that I can speak and go to Washington. Let me tell you what we're doing there so you'll know that I'm not just chasing away while you're having your lunch. You may remember that there's a big fracas going on about an amendment which has already been adopted in the Senate, which would cut $130 million off New York's federal payment in the effort to sustain the Medicaid program. This would be a crippling blow to the state, which pays half the tab, and would be a crippling blow to every community, which would have to assume this additional burden. And I'm sure that includes Monroe County. Now, the fellows who put that amendment through, forgot to get the bill passed to which it's attached. And that left an opening, which I have seized upon, and with the cooperation of Senator Goodell and senators from other states, there are about 23 states adversely affected. We are now trying to put other amendments in the bill, which would take the sting out of this particular amendment, which was sponsored by Russell Long of Louisiana. It is for that reason, because we're on the firing line and I'm leading the attack, that I have to be back. Indeed, I have no business to come.
Testing.
Fort until I can get there. The Senate is also tied up with a move dealing with permissibility to radio and television stations to have radio and television debates between the presidential candidates. So I don't know what I'll find when I get there, but I have to get back. So I beg you to indulge me. Go right ahead with your lunch, as I'm accustomed to speaking on street corners in New York City. Noise doesn't bother me. Indeed, there is a tradition in my old congressional district up on
Testing 1-2.
On the principal corner in that community, which happens to be 181st Street and Broadway, if any of you know it, somebody would turn in a false alarm. So you see, I had to develop a very good speaking voice. I wish to pay my respects to Dick Rosenbaum, our county chairman, who does me great honor in being here today, and to Steve May, a very old friend, indeed, who sort of represents me up here, a city councilman here in the city of Rochester. Frank Horton and Barbara Connable spoke with me yesterday, and their problems are very great in respect of the last days of the Congress. As you know, they had a 27-hour session which ended yesterday, and asked my indulgence in not being here today. And of course, I understand perfectly, and they're very close friends, very close co-workers, two of the brightest and ablest Republicans of progressive views that there are in the whole state delegation. And so I hope you will understand their inability to be here today. I certainly do, and I wouldn't want them to, considering what they had to do. I'd like to express also my respects to Tom Laverne, the state senator, great friend of mine with whom I worked in Albany, And to all the assemblymen, I thought Frank Carroll would be here, but unfortunately he couldn't make it either. You have the 6 assemblymen, I wish, and assembly candidates. I wish to pay my respects to them. Finally, I would like to, if I may, just pick out one candidate, if you'll allow me, who's here, Gordon Howe II. Gordy is a great friend of mine, his dad, and strictly non-politically, I wish him really all the best success. Again, here is a bright, new, young, very interesting face in public life, and it will give me enormous pleasure to be able to work with him if the people in this community send him to the state legislature. Now, I have a great admiration for much which has been done in Rochester. We have our problems, very serious ones, but there's a very active, public-spirited business community here. There's a very articulate and very important cultural community here, and you all know that I spent 16 years of my legislative career getting the National Arts Foundation enacted into laws, and I've worked with Governor Rockefeller so closely and the State Council on the Arts, so I appreciate very much Rochester as a great cultural capital. We have had our problems here, too, with the black community and the endemic poor, and we still have our problems. Those problems are by no means solved. I am very well aware of conditions of disorder and difficulty which still prevail. I've come to Rochester quite frequently for that reason, and have done my utmost to lend my good offices to whether it was the Rochester Consortium of Business to give jobs, or whether it were the various exciting efforts in housing. I just saw one called the Capsule Housing Project. I only hope and pray, members of the Ad Club, that you'll look that over very carefully, and it would be a fantastically vital thing if every member of the Ad Club, and it's not beyond your competence, could sponsor some such project. Absolutely brilliant for low-income families and very, very exciting. So there's lots going on, but even lots more that needs to be done, as anybody who takes a ride around the inner city knows as well as I do. And I hope to cooperate fully. I'm not apologizing or being an apologist for the inadequacies here. There are plenty of them. We all ought to wear a hair shirt about them. And I believe very much in the doctrine of collective responsibility, even if I've done everything I could. So I hope, gentlemen, that if I do continue in this office and the people send me back to Washington, you will understand the depth of my feeling on this subject. I do not believe that the conditions of abject poverty and slum living which we have in this country or in Rochester are apposite to our country or necessary considering our talent and resources. They are strictly the product of our own failure and inability to cope with the major social problems of our time. And I only hope that I shall have the privilege of working with you and with other men and women who are beyond that stage in order to eradicate, in the main, these conditions. It is for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, that I came to the conclusion today that I should make what I consider to be a major declaration of policy here in Rochester, and use this forum with your permission, and I shall try not to distract you too much from what looks like one of my favorite lunches. Is that hamburger?
Yeah.
Hamburger and mashed potatoes, which I won't get to eat.
You like to hold it?
I can't, no. I don't even dare to look at it. It makes me fat. So I've decided to make this kind of a speech here to you today. Can I shove this aside? Any chance? Oh, thank you. Good. This is very much better. Thank you. Now, here goes, because I'm going to talk to you about the new concepts that I have in respect of welfare. And I think this is one of the really pressing problems of our time. And it bears very heavily upon the problems, the social problems, and the insurrectionary social problems which we have in this country. Now, I hope you will understand that one cannot, in the given speech, deal with the whole range of issues which are before us in this campaign. But I think you all have heard me many times on every kind of issue, and you will again. So without distracting all of us with a wrap-up of everything that I'm standing for and working for and have stood for before, let me just concentrate on welfare today. Now, we have issued a policy paper on welfare, and that policy paper is available to any of you who want more detail on what I will say. In addition, I wish to announce publicly that the statement I have issued of my speech today, though I will not be able to say it all because of the limitation of time, is nonetheless the statement behind which I stand, so that it can be quoted and printed by any of the press or used by radio and television with perfect freedom. Now, here goes. Within the last year or so, criticism of the welfare system has reached a bitterness new to our time. The welfare crisis is at the storm's eye of the larger crisis of values, which has emerged so clearly in this election year. The conflict over whether the secure majority really wants to pay the price to give the disadvantaged and restless minority a full and equal opportunity to compete for the blessings of American life. In the context of a welfare system, the confrontation comes down most basically to a conflict between two instincts, the feeling that people should work to support themselves, and the feeling that in a country as rich as ours, we cannot abandon families to deprivation and starvation under any circumstances. Both feelings are right, for both instincts are a fundamental part of human nature and a part of the emotional equipment of all of us. The so-called Puritan ethic is not the property of the white race as opposed to the black, or of the well-to-do as opposed to the poor. What has provoked the welfare crisis has not been any noticeable shift in public morality as between the ethic of work and the ethic of charity, but it's rather the phenomenal growth of the system itself which has been forced by the confrontation which we have with it in the United States. The long and short of it is that we've had much greater endemic poverty than we have now, but we haven't faced it. We haven't taken care of it. Many of those people, millions of them, have died young because they did not get the break to which every American is entitled. And that situation is and will be no more. Hence, we face a very grave problem. Indeed, as I'm sure you know, the number of people with incomes under the poverty line has dropped by almost 25% in the last 7 years, from some 38,900,000 to 29,700,000. But the number of recipients under the major welfare program before us, to wit, aid to families with dependent children, has gone from 2,900,000 in 1959 to 4,600,000 in 1966, when we last have the figures. In other words, the two curves have been exactly reversed. And the reason is not that we don't have less poverty, we do in this country, much less. But we are taking more cognizance of it than ever we did before. Now, to put our present situation in its starkest terms, one out of every five children in New York City, for example, is receiving public assistance. One out of every five. There are more children on welfare in New York City than there are people in all of Newark, New Jersey. And if we take a look at particular communities in New York City, let me give you a couple of figures that will just astound you. These are 1965, but there's not any great difference. In that year, the New York City Youth Board calculated the welfare rate at 18 per thousand of the population in Brooklyn. But here's the variance by neighborhoods. From 1.8, let us say 2 in round figures, per thousand in one area to a fantastic 780 per thousand in another. Think of that. 780 out of 1,000 people were on welfare in one area in Brooklyn. So that neighborhood was really little more than a vast almshouse and nothing else. Now the cost of this tremendous growth has been crushing and has fallen most heavily on the wealthier states like New York. Of the combined federal, state, local welfare cost, which in the nation costs us $8 billion a year, over half is spent in California, Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania. Just think of that. In four states, we spend over half what is spent on welfare everywhere in the United States. We spend $1 billion in the state of New York alone every year on the aid to families with dependent children. And that's gone up almost twofold, 176% in only 5 years, 62 to 67. And in New York City, it's gone up almost fourfold in the same period of time, or 380%. Now, the effect of this cost explosion has been to stretch state and local tax bases and taxpayer tolerance to the breaking point, as more and more funds are automatically drawn off from city budgets to meet mandatory welfare cost increases, other municipal services suffer. And in New York, you know, we're in a terrible jam about paying our police and our firemen and sanitation men adequately, and this is one reason for it. The pinch is particularly tight on the middle-income city dweller who quite rightfully wants to know why he must work for a living while so many others receive incomes close to his and remain idle at home. This is a question I'm sure you've asked yourselves, too. The pressures for changes in the system are building up, and they cannot be ignored. And if we're to use the potential of the occasion, liberals and conservatives alike must face the issue squarely without relying on old shibboleths. Now, one of the oldest shibboleths is the politically popular conclusion that jobs are the prime answer to the welfare problem and that the welfare clients are shiftless and lazy. It's been widely reported that less than 3 out of every 100 welfare recipients are potential job holders. The vast majority, it will interest you to know, are either children, the elderly, or they're too ill to work. But that doesn't mean the jobs are not an essential ingredient in reform, because about 80% of the 4 million children who live in welfare families live in homes without fathers, 4/5 of them. And of the 1,100,000 so-called AFDC mothers, that is the heads of households on welfare, it is estimated that about 1/3 or 300,000 have some skills or could become self-supporting with some training and could work outside their homes if they had suitable daycare facilities. Now think of the magnitude of these problems. 300,000 mothers with probably 1 million children. And our daycare facilities today care for about 1/4 of that number. And yet these are the potential for reducing the welfare load if we would but grow up about this whole thing and do it in an adult way. Now we must face and we must admit the inequity involved to the lower and middle income wage earner as we raise welfare payment levels. It's generally thought that New York City is the big culprit in this, but I've got a figure on Rochester which may interest you. In New York City, a family of 4, husband, wife, and 2 children, can now receive as much as $4,100 a year in aid to families with dependent children. In Rochester, that amount right now is $3,672 a year, but on January 1st, which is only 2 months away, it's going up to $3,850 a year. So your situation is not very much different here than it is in New York City. We also face an extremely serious question of family stability, as I explained a minute ago. In 1940, only 30% of the children who lived in families getting aid to dependent children welfare had absent fathers. 1940. 25 years later, that percentage is 71, and it's going up to 80, as I told you a few minutes ago. In New York City in 1966, 75% of the fathers were absent from AFDC families. Now, the breakdown in that is that 40% are from families where desertion or separation accounts for the absence of the father. And divorce is a very minor factor, only 5%. The other 20% is illegitimacy. Now, these are the details of the problem which I've described to you. Now, what do I suggest be done about it? Let me first lay aside two questions which are being broadly discussed publicly, which I might tell the press I'm inserting in my prepared remarks, because I want to deal with the subject in totality, and I do know a good deal about it, so that we may clear the ground, as it were. One, the so-called guaranteed income concept. I believe that that concept has to be experimented with in some kind of a pilot plant experiment. I have favored that in committee, and I'll do my best to get it into law. But the type of guaranteed family allowance, family income that I believe in, is the family allowance type, which is now the law in some 40-odd countries, including Canada. I believe that that is the best approach to the concept of giving the poor family the ability to have a sum of resources which it can spend largely on a volunteer basis, perhaps with advice, but not by order of a caseworker, as it's done today. Secondly, I believe very much in the affidavit system rather than the caseworker system, where there's a certification by affidavit of eligibility for welfare, rather than the tremendous delay and bureaucratic cost of an investigation, with the penalties very severe for fraud in respect of that certification. That's working very well in a number of areas in the city of New York and will very materially cut down the cost of administration. Now, these are widely discussed ideas, and I'm just stating my position so there may be no doubt about where I stand on them. But now I would like to advance to you some new concepts, which, if given the opportunity, I would endeavor to promote in the Senate. And as I have a position which could put me in the chairmanship of the committee that handles this matter in the Senate, I'm the ranking minority member now, I probably can have a rather considerable influence upon this whole subject. I have four proposals which are quite new. Proposal number one. We must see to it that jobs with dignity and a chance of advancement in both the public and private sectors are available to all welfare recipients where job holding is possible. But the top priority must be to the male heads of households. Although we do not know all the answers, it does seem that jobs at decent incomes for men is one important way to deal with the problem of the deserting father or even of illegitimacy. What I suggest is a new practical approach to finance such programs in the light of our budgetary restraint and the conservative mood of much of the nation. Until now, it has been impossible to generate a sufficient priority for job programs to produce the needed appropriations from the Congress. I happen to agree with the Kerner Commission, the President's Commission on Civil Disorder, that we should provide by special law for public and private jobs to the extent of 2 million, that's what the country needs. But what we can't get it, budget-wise, though we're going to try again next year. Ironically, appropriations have not been much of a problem for welfare since an initial federal commitment was made to finance the program, whatever its size, and that the appropriations are automatic. In other words, the size of the welfare program was not geared to the amount of money available, but the money was made automatically available. That's not true in manpower. In manpower, the size of our program has had to be adapted to the money made available. And the welfare budget doesn't have to go through the appropriations process every time costs go up. Now, what do I propose? I propose that we give the same kind of financing technique to funding new job training and employment programs that we have to the automatic welfare payment. And I would do it this way. I would give federal and local authorities the right to utilize the funds which are now mandated for relief or welfare to divert them, or part of them, into job training programs for the same welfare recipients whenever training and meaningful job opportunities can be made available. Thus, if a welfare family is getting $4,000 a year, and it is possible to place the man in the house in a training slot, to wit, in a training opening, or to make an opening for him, in which he will get, let us say, $2,500 a year as the stipend or the cost of that training which the employer is willing to pay, or which a manpower development and training program will give him as a stipend. Then the administrator of that welfare case would have the right to take out $2,000 and to subsidize an employer or a training program for the purpose of training that man. In that way, the United States would spend no more, the individual would get no more, but you would have the money used for job training instead of for straight welfare, provided that that discretion was vested in local administration. And that, I think, is a very sound technique, readily doable, does not increase the budgetary demand, and can have a very profound effect. Now, I join that with giving motivation to the woman or man who is the head of a household on welfare. And that motivation, I think, must be in getting some benefit out of the extra amount which that person can earn once they begin to be trained for a job and can hold a job, even though the compensation may be solely at the minimum wage, which, as you know, only produces 40 hours a week, plus in round figures $1.50, which again is even under the welfare payment. Now, motivation, in my judgment, which we are now trying to provide under the 1967 amendments to the federal law, by allowing the welfare recipient to keep $30 a month out of his earnings plus 30% of the remainder that he earns. $30 a month plus 30%. That doesn't seem to be enough. And so I suggest that over and above the $30 and the 30%, that what he earns should be put in a fund for him that he can spend for certain services which are the most likely to redeem him out of the poverty in which he's steeped. Those services to include Head Start, which is the small children's training program, Follow Through, which ensues immediately in the early grades of public school, right after the Head Start program, which affects essentially pre-kindergarten children. Daycare for the children of that family, so the mother can work. Adult basic education. Many of these people can't read or write, or can't read intelligibly, or write intelligibly. Job training of an additional character to that which might be furnished by government. Health care of the most crucial importance, including dental care, prosthetic appliance care, and care of the eyes, all of which enhances and improves the opportunity to redeem oneself from poverty. Now, work credits, as I call them, would be extremely valuable to the poverty-stricken family. And these work credits would then be available, notwithstanding the welfare payment, for the purpose of bringing about the rehabilitation of that family. Again, no budgetary impact, because this is just the retention by the individual family of earnings which it itself has, but which now result in a reduction in its relief check beyond a certain point, which we have established by law, and which should not result in that reduction when the family can have a chance to redeem itself completely if it could buy certain services which it cannot buy with a relief check. Now, another great advantage of